It's half past eight.
It's half past eight, New York time. Time to wake up America and stump the experts. Each week at this time, Lucky Strike presents Information Please. We stage a coast-to-coast quiz party, and you furnish the questions. For every question we use, Lucky Strike pays out $10 plus a copy of the new Information Please quiz book. If your question stumps us, you get $25 more, plus a 24-volume set of the current Encyclopedia Britannica. Send your questions to Information Please, 480 Lexington Avenue, New York City. If our editorial staff edits your questions a bit, don't fret over it. In case of duplication, Information Please uses the question that was received first, and all questions become the property of Information Please. And now, light up a lucky strike as I introduce our master of ceremonies, the literary critic of the New Yorker magazine, Clifton Fadiman. Mr. Fadiman.
Ladies and gentlemen, as you know, Information Please is a completely unrehearsed, spontaneous, and ad-lib program. This is a cast-iron guarantee. Our quartet of experts this evening are the sports authority and memory wizard, John Kieran, the Conning Tower columnist of the New York Post, the irreplaceable Franklin P. Adams, the music critic, James Taylor, to whom in part we owe Walt Disney's famous Fantasia, and the author, foreign correspondent, and lecturer, Mr. Vincent Sheehan, whose most recent book is Not Peace, But a Sword. Remember, for each question missed, Lucky Strike rings up $25. And that's paid out to the sender, plus 24 volumes of the Encyclopedia Britannica. Well, I suppose we start the proceedings this evening with a question coming to us from that city of culture, Boston, Massachusetts, from R.G. Dakin. Name the characters of literature, gentlemen, whose costumes are described in these words. I have four of them. Get three out of four. Here's the first. Quote, the seat of his trousers bagged low and contained nothing. Who is that? I can give you no more hints than that. The seat of his trousers bagged low and contained nothing. Any ideas? Mr. Taylor, that's just a look of, what, vacuous intensity on your face?
Yes, I'm trying to visualize the character.
That's a very good description. It's a boy, and his name is Huckleberry Finn. And you'll find that description in The Adventures of Tom Sawyer by Mark Twain. Well, that's one wrong. Now, here's another. I've got shoes with grown-up laces. I've got knickers and a pair of braces. Who's being described? Mr. Taylor.
Christopher Robin.
Christopher Robin. Very good. That's right. In what book will you find that, Mr. Taylor?
When We Were Very Young.
You feel pleased with yourself, Mr.
Oh,
Taylor?
I'm delighted.
I think that's very good. All right. Here's another very simple description of a costume. Quote, clothed on with chastity. Close quote. Clothed on with chastity. A simple costume. Mr. Taylor.
Isn't that the Adams, is it?
No, no.
It's getting warm.
On the contrary, I think it's a wild guess. Clothed on with chastity, Mr. Kieran?
Well, I'll take a guess if nobody wants it. Galahad?
No, no, it's a good guess. Would be sort of Galahad's opposite number. Mr.
It might be Lady Godiva.
It is Lady Godiva, yes. Clothed on with chastity. You remember that,
yes,
for the rest, her costume was somewhat
horse, yes.
Exiguous. That's right. I'm afraid you have to count that wrong, because you came in just a little late, Mr. Taylor. Now, how about...
Well, I'm thinking of Lady Godiva all the time.
Well, you just couldn't get the words out of your mouth.
Please.
quote, in a white petticoat, close quote. In a white petticoat. Who's being described? I think these are rather hard. Mr. Adams.
I would guess Little Nancy Etticoat.
And you would be quite right. Little Nancy Etticoat in a white petticoat and a red nose. The longer she stands, the shorter she grows.
A candle.
A candle, that's right. That gives us two out of four, which is not quite enough. And courtesy of Lucky Strike, that sends $25 to Mr. Dacre of Boston, plus a set of the Britannica. Now, here's a question from Edwin Chase of Lyndhurst, New Jersey. This is a somewhat more serious question. Get three out of four, if you can. Who owns these Mediterranean islands that have been mentioned in the news recently? The first island is the island of Rhodes. Who owns it? Rhodes. Mr. Sheehan.
Italy.
Italy, no question. Cyprus. Who owns Cyprus? Mr. Sheehan again. Beg pardon?
England. Great.
England, yes. And the next one is Corsica, which is the only one I would know. Corsica. Who owns Corsica? Mr. Taylor?
France.
France. And finally, Corfu. The island of Corfu, C-O-R-F-U. Who owns Corfu? Mr. Sheehan.
Greece, yes. So that gives us 4 out of 4.
Very good. Thank you very much, Mr. Sheehan. Assisted by Mr. Taylor, playing on the piccolo. Miss Catherine Fowler of Elyria, Ohio, sends this one in. Name 3 women characters in literature who lured men to their deaths, and explain how they did it. Give us a sort of elementary course in lure. Mr. Kidd.
Well, there's a whole set of sirens who lured sailors in the Mediterranean.
Yeah, how many sirens were there? You say a set of them. As if they were a deck of cards.
Well, I don't know whether there are 3 or... How many do you have to name?
You have to name 3, but
no,
I'll...
there's 3 sirens.
Yes, but I think... I don't think that's fair. The sirens is a very good answer, Mr. Kieran, but I'm going to count the sirens as 1.
Well,
do you mind? Give us 2 more women characters who did this luring business. Mr. Taylor.
The Lorelei.
Yes, the Lorelei. How many Lorelei were there?
There was just 1 Lorelei.
Just 1 Lorelei.
She sat on a rock and sang and combed her hair. I don't know why. But
because she had to be in the poem doing that.
Also in public domain, isn't it?
what happened? What happened, Mr. Taylor, to the poor navigators?
Well, they ran up against her rock and were dashed to pieces.
Yes,
I mean, their ships were.
That's right. Now, that gives us 2 of these women characters. Let's have another. Who lured men to their deaths. Oh, why, literature is full of them.
Sudden deaths.
Well, it can be lingering, if you've been said. Miss Karen?
Scylla was a woman. She was changed into a rock.
Yeah, that was hardly fair.
And she lured mariners to destruction. They missed her. They fell into Charybdis, which was the whirlpool.
That's right.
Right off the... mainland of it.
Now, you've given us 2 more, then. Scylla, Charybdis?
Well, Charybdis wasn't a woman.
What was Charybdis?
Well, Charybdis was a whirlpool.
don't whirlpools have sexes?
No.
Scylla was the woman.
Why do sailors always get into all that?
I don't know. I have no idea. Sailors seem to be out of luck.
They can't swim.
There's Delilah, of course, who nagged Samson into revealing his secret, you remember, and shaved his head and so forth. There was Clytemnestra. There was Judith. There was Circe in the Odyssey. There are a number of those that you could think of. The next question comes from Hermina Loeb of the city. Get 2 out of 3. Now, you're going to listen to some music, gentlemen, very carefully. 3 parts of some compositions. Name the operatic character who dies to each piece of music, whether slow or fast. You find this depressing?
It's a jolly program.
It is. This is our mournful night. Let's have the first. Know it already? Oh, we have 2 hands. Mr. Sheehan and Mr. Taylor. Mr. Sheehan?
The words are... I know the words. It's, Mimi.
Yes, in what opera? In what opera?
La Bohème.
In La Bohème, yes. And she dies in what act?
The last act.
The last act. Good. Couldn't catch you on that one. That's very good, Mr. Sheehan. Who wrote La Bohème? Let's get the whole story.
Puccini.
Very good. Now let's have the second. Mr. Taylor.
I think it's Boris Godunov.
It is indeed. Very good. Boris Godunov, and he dies...
As given at the Metropolitan, it's the last act.
Yeah, it sounds
as given elsewhere, it's the next to the last act.
You mean the one before it?
Because the scene in the forest is frequently... It was the original last act.
Is that so?
But it is now transposed to be the next to the last
act. You follow yourself, don't you, Mr. Taylor?
I do, yeah.
All right. That's good enough for me. By the way, who wrote Boris Godunov, just to set us clear?
Modest Mussorgsky.
Mussorgsky. Very good. Those lines of music describe the death of Boris Godunov. Now the third and last. Hey, Mr. Taylor again.
Aida and Radames.
They both died in the same piece of music?
Yeah, they're buried alive.
Alive. Aida in the opera.
In the opera Aida,
good.
Oddly enough, and in the conventional last act.
Very good. That gives us 3 out of 3. Thank you, Mr. Sheehan. Thank you, Mr. Taylor. Here's another. This comes from Bernard Buchwald of this city. Get 2 out of 3. Now, if I asked you to name a governor of New York State who was both a predecessor and a successor to the same man, you would probably say Al Smith, who preceded Nathan Miller and then was elected after him in 1922. Now, can you name a man who was both predecessor and successor to the same man as a European monarch? Can you name a European monarch who preceded and succeeded the same person?
I can't even get that sentence straight.
A European monarch... Mr. Sheehan.
King Carol.
King Carol? Whom did he precede?
His son. And succeeded him.
I think it was King Michael who succeeded... King Michael succeeded his grandfather, Ferdinand. And Carol, as crown prince, was not ruling at the time, wasn't he?
That's right. It's the son that succeeded his father.
That's right. And it is Michael. You're all right, but one generation out. Now, can you name a president of the United States who was both predecessor and successor to the same man? Mr. Kieran.
Grover Cleveland.
Grover Cleveland. Whom did he... who was the man in between there?
I think it was... Harrison.
Harrison is right. Harrison. Thank you very much. Yes, he was succeeded by Harrison, and then again succeeded Harrison in 1893. Now, what British prime minister was both predecessor and successor to the same man? There are a few possible answers here. Pick a prime minister practically at random.
Disraeli.
British prime minister. Mr. Taylor?
Disraeli.
Disraeli, perfectly all right. Very good, Mr. Taylor. Disraeli preceded Gladstone and succeeded him again.
Didn't know I had it in me.
Neither did I. That gives you 2 out of 3, gentlemen, and sends us on to a question from Guy D. Barr of Philadelphia. Here again, get 2 out of 3. In what musical comedies or operettas are these people portrayed? The first person is Oscar Wilde. In what musical comedy or operetta would you find Oscar Wilde portrayed, Mr. Adams?
Supposed to be Patience.
Supposed to be in Patience. And what's the name of the character in Patience who was supposed to be Oscar Wilde?
Bunthorn.
In what musical comedy or operetta is Hodge Aleman portrayed? Hodge, H-A-D-J, Aleman, A-L-E-M-A-N. Mr. Sheehan.
The Desert Song.
Well, who is Hodge Aleman, Mr. Sheehan?
He was a German who was in the Riff.
Yes. Where is the Riff?
1925.
Yes. Now, how do you get into the Desert Song from the Riff?
I've forgotten the name of the man who wrote it, but...
I don't know who wrote the Desert Song.
Sigmund Romberg.
Sigmund Romberg.
He wrote the music. I don't know who wrote the book.
What was the real name?
Nobody
of
ever writes the book of the music. So.
What's the real name of Hodge Aleman, Mr. Sheehan, or did you tell us that?
I can't remember.
Well, it was Joseph Klemms, a useful piece of information that will stand you in good stead sometime in the future. How about Louis XV? In what musical comedy or operetta would you find him portrayed? Mr. Kieran.
Du Barry was a lady.
Du Barry was a lady, yes. What actor took the part of Louis XV?
Kurt Lahr.
And what did he do with it?
He kicked it around wonderfully.
Well, that gives us 3 out of 3, gentlemen. And so far, Lucky Strike has paid out $25 and one set of the Encyclopedia Britannica. Now enter Mr. Cross with what looks like a telegram.
It is, Mr. Fadiman. This wire is from Richmond, Kentucky, and it's so typical of reports from tobacco markets all over the South that I want to read it to everyone. All it says is, Richmond, 25%. But here's what it means. At tobacco auctions in Richmond, Kentucky, so far this season, the American Tobacco Company has paid 25% more per pound for the tobacco it bought for its cigarettes and other tobacco products. Yes, 25% above the average market price paid for all the various types and grades of tobacco sold there. And the best we bought will go to Lucky's. Now, I could read you reports from market after market showing that Lucky Strike consistently pays higher prices to get the finer, lighter, the naturally milder tobaccos. It all comes down to this. You want a mild smoke. Lucky's have real mildness, bought and paid for at the auctions. So why not get together?
Mr. Cross, you made your point in just 55 seconds. And now we'll go on to the question from Zelma Rogerman of San Carlos, California. I don't know whether any of you gentlemen ever put things up for the winter, but I'm going to ask you to distinguish among jams, preserves, and jellies. Jams, preserves, and jellies. Very easy, Mr. Taylor.
Suppose
we start with jams. Mr. Kieran. What is jam?
Well, a jam is usually some kind of macerated fruit, berries. May I distinguish the three nut bases?
Why not?
Preserves you would put up. You might put them up whole, as in the case of peaches, or have them. And a jelly is made in an entirely different way by crushing the berries, as for instance cranberries, and straining them and
through cheesecloth.
That's right.
Don't forget the cheesecloth.
It isn't so much the material that you put into the jars, it's the way that you put them in that makes them either jam
Preserves or
jelly. Or failed to gel.
Very good. I know that Mr. Taylor listened with fascinated absorption to every word, Mr. Kieran. Then it's simply a question, Mr. Taylor.
One addition. Jam is always always gets into your teeth.
If you have teeth, yes. That's right.
You're thinking of raspberry jam.
Under your plate if you have it.
That's right. Jelly is clear, made just with fruit juices. And jam is made by, as you say,
jamming.
Macerating the fruit.
Nobody can see that gesture.
That's true, Mr. Thank you. At any rate, in jam, you don't preserve the shape of the fruit, but you do preserve the fruit. In preserves, as Mr. Kieran pointed out, you preserve the actual shape of the fruit. How about this one from Margaret Noltner of Milwaukee, Wisconsin? Get 2 out of 3. Behind whose throne, gentlemen, were these individuals very powerful influences? For example, Disraeli was a powerful influence behind the throne of Queen Victoria. Now, in the case of Cardinal Wolsey, what was the king whom he influenced? Mr. Kieran.
Why, I think that was Henry VIII.
Henry VIII, yes. Henry VIII of England. Now, in the case of Potemkin. Mr. Kieran again.
Catherine of Russia.
Catherine of Russia, yes. In the case of Madame Pompadour, what king did she influence? Mr. Taylor?
Louis 14th and 15th, I believe.
I don't think she had that much staying power.
They didn't.
I think she just picked one king and stuck to him, Mr. Taylor.
Well, I would stick to Louis 15th.
That's very good, Mr. Taylor. Exactly right.
Well, that's Madame Pompadour.
That's very good. That gives us 3 out of 3. Louis the 15th of France. Here's one from Deborah Ishlan of Brooklyn, New York. Now, you're going to hear some musical selections again, gentlemen. Identify the place referred to or described in each of these familiar musical selections. It says familiar on the card. I hope it'll be familiar to all of you. Get 2 out of 3. Let's have the first. Mr. Sheehan, Mr. Taylor are giving each other the high sign. Mr. Sheehan.
Paris.
Paris, yes. The selection is from what?
Manon.
From Manon, yes. Do you know in what act those...
First.
Act one. That's very good, Mr. Sheehan. Very good indeed. Now let's have the second. Who knows it? Is that your hand or your fist that you're holding out?
My fist. I'd like to come back to that.
I'd like to have it again afterwards?
Yeah.
Or do you want to hear it again now?
No, I know.
All right, we'll come back to it. We'll come back to it. Let's have the third selection. Any luck, gentlemen?
Nobody ever lived there.
That selection that we've just listened to is from Rossini's The Italian in Algiers, and the place, gentlemen, would be what?
Algiers.
Good work. That's fine. That gives us one wrong. Now we're going to come back to selection number 2.
Oh, yes.
Do you know it?
The Hebrides.
Oh, yes, the Hebrides. What's the selection?
The Hebrides Overture of Mendelssohn.
Yes, from what larger work? Or is it called Fingal's Cave?
Fingal's Cave or Hebrides.
Very good. Thank you. That gives us 3 out of 3. Thank you
but
very much.
But who would live at Fingal's Cave?
I beg your pardon?
But nobody lives at Fingal's Cave.
No, Hebrides
Fingal does.
Right?
He just owns it.
That's right, Mr. Adams. Stick up for Fingal. The next question comes from Bernard Berry of Brookline, Massachusetts. I have 3 words here. I'm going to ask you to tell me what they mean, or rather, what is their derivation? Get 2 out of 3. Anzac. What's the derivation of the word Anzac? Mr. Kieran.
Australian New Zealand Army Corps.
Yes.
It was originated in the last war.
Yes. Do they still call them Anzacs in the present conflict?
I believe they do.
Yes. Mm-hmm. You take the initials of those words and you get Anzac. That's right. Casey Stengel. How'd Casey Stengel get his name? Mr. Kieran again.
Comes from Kansas City.
Yes, Kansas
KC.
City or KC. That's right. What was Casey Stengel's real name?
Charles H. Stengel, I believe.
Charles H. Stengel. No one knows him by that name at all, I suppose, except Mr. Kieran. The derivation of the word Ogpu, O-G-P-U, Ogpu. Any of you gentlemen know how we get the word Ogpu? Mr. Taylor?
It's the initial of 4 Russian words meaning secret police.
It's the initials of four Russian words, all right, but they do not mean secret police. The Russians would never be as direct as that. Mr. Sheehan, can you help us out on that at all?
I don't know what the words are.
Well, I'll tell you what the English words are. The English words are all state political administration, which sounds perfectly harmless. And the Russians, aren't the Russian words at all, Mr. Sheehan? Would you like to hear them? Give you a little Russian. The initials of Obshche Gosudarstvo Vyenyo Politeske Upravlenie. Those are the Russian words.
Well, Mr. Chairman,
what did you say? Mr. Chairman?
Don't the Russians shorten it to Gay Peu?
That is another phrase meaning the same thing, I think. But Agpu is the word they use over there. Well, that gives us 2 out of 3, which is good enough, and sends us on to a question from J.R. Bailey of Wheaton, Illinois. I think this next one is a rather easy question. We have to get 2 out of 3. In each of the following pairs of sports, which uses the larger ball? In the case of basketball and soccer, which uses the larger ball? Mr. Kieran?
I'd say basketball.
That's right. In the case of tennis and baseball, which uses the larger ball? Mr. Adams?
I would say baseball.
You would be right, Mr. Adams. In the case of golf and ping pong, which is the larger ball? Golf and ping pong. Mr. Taylor.
Obvious sport. I'll say golf.
And you would be right, Mr. Taylor. Very good. I think the question, however, is rather easy. Now, the next one comes from Ruth Cronk of Santa Barbara, California. See what you can do with this one. Oh, here we come back to Shakespeare, Mr. Kieran's favorite character. Name a character in Shakespeare who was engaged in each of these occupations. See if you can give me 3 out of 4 on this. The first is a drunken butler. A drunken butler. We have 2 hands. Mr. Taylor?
And Stefano.
Stefano, yes. In what play? I don't know.
The Tempest.
The Tempest, yes. Stefano in The Tempest was a drunken butler.
No, but Malvolio. Sure.
I beg pardon, Mr. Sheehan?
Malvolio.
Oh, Malvolio didn't drink.
No, he's a Puritan. He didn't drink. He didn't smoke.
That's right.
He didn't do practically anything, did he, Mr. Kieran?
He was a fellow who thought because he was virtuous, there was to be no more cakes and ale.
Oh, yes, yes. You find it difficult to distinguish between sobriety and drunkenness. Now, in Shakespeare, who was a tailor? A tailor. Only one tailor in Shakespeare, as far as I know. Gentlemen?
Somebody in Midsummer Night's Dream.
That's right. Which one?
I forget his name.
Well, you've got the right
last night.
You've got the right play, all right. What was the name of the tailor? Any of you remember?
Snout?
No, I think
Begins with this.
It does indeed, but it wasn't Snout. I'm not sure. I think Snout was a tinker. Starveling is the tailor.
Starveling
is the tailor. I'd like to count that right, Mr. Adams, but I'll have to count it wrong because you didn't give me the exact name. Now, who was a professional wrestler in Shakespeare? Mr. Kieran.
I believe his name was Charles.
Yes, but as a sports expert, you deserve no credit for knowing that, of course.
He wasn't a very good wrestler, either.
In what play?
In As You Like It.
In As You Like It. That's quite right, Mr. Kieran. Thank you. Now, who in Shakespeare was a poet? Of course, practically all the characters are poets, if they're talking blank verse. Mr. Kieran again.
Well, Orlando was a poet in As You Like It. He hung a lot of sonnets.
Yes, but he was an amateur poet, wasn't he? Rather than a professional. Mr. Sheehan?
Cinna and Julius Caesar.
Very good. Yes, that's the one I was thinking of. Cinna is a professional poet, one who makes a bad living at it. That gives us 3 out of 4.
Belongs to the author's league.
How about this one? This comes from George M. Crawford of Westport, Connecticut. Neighbor of yours, Mr. Adams. It's a question about things that are new. Get 2 out of 3 if you can. What is the new order in Japan? The new order in Japan. Or give us a rough approximation of what it might be. None of you gentlemen have heard of the New Order in Japan? Well, it's a phrase used sort of loosely to refer to the new internal policy or foreign policy as it affects Asia. I suppose it's Japan's idea of what's going to happen if she does win the war. That's one wrong. Now, what is the new life in China? The new life in China. Mr. Sheehan.
It's a movement which is sponsored by Madame Chiang Kai-shek.
Yes.
Which is semi-Christian, I think. Or perhaps altogether Christian.
What are some of the tenets of the movement, would you say? What do the new lifers advocate?
Well, virtues of a large general order.
Of course, that's rather safe and sound, yes. Specifically, though...
Self-sacrifice.
Well, yes, the reconstruction of cities along modern lines is something even more specific than that. The adoption of Mandarin as a national dialect, I believe, is another of the things that the new lifers in China advocate. Now, the new economic policy in Russia means or meant what? The new economic policy in Russia. Mr. Sheehan again.
It was, in 1921, the policy of going back to a limited form of capitalism.
Yes. Who advocated it?
Lenin.
That's quite right. That gives us 2 out of 3. See what you can do with this one. This is a question is about angry ladies in literature. It comes from Ethel Ross of Wichita Falls, Texas. Get 2 out of 3. Where in literature does an angry woman destroy each of the following? The first is a lute. Where does an angry woman destroy a lute in literature? That seems to me a very hard question indeed. I don't see why anybody should remember it.
It's a Greek legend, isn't it?
No, I don't think so.
Probably Shakespeare.
You're right, Mr. Taylor. What a guesser you are, Mr. Taylor. Now, guess.
Intuition, it isn't guessing.
You're marvelous. Mr. Curran.
It's in The Taming of the Shrew.
That's right. And what's the name of the angry lady in The Taming of the Shrew?
Kate.
Yes.
Sweet Kate.
Yes, Kate. I call her Catherine, but you've probably known her longer than I have, Mr. Curran. She breaks the lute over the head of her music teacher. Now, who destroys a painting which has just been completed? What angry woman destroys a painting that's just been completed? Mr. Taylor.
Bessie in The Light That Failed.
Very good indeed. That's a tough one. She destroys the painting.
I'm working on that.
That's very good. And who destroys a beautiful house? An angry woman who destroys a beautiful house.
Craig's wife, maybe?
No. The answer is the housekeeper, Mrs. Danvers, in Rebecca, which was a motion picture also. Remember, she burns down the house.
Oh, yes, Judith Anderson burned the house down.
Amanda Lay, that's right. That sends $25, courtesy of Lucky Strikes, Ethel Ross, plus a Britannia. And now, for just a moment, Mr. Cross is going to take my place. The expert he wants to fire questions at is Mr. Speed Riggs, well-known tobacco auctioneer.
Mr. Riggs, information, please. Just who are the independent tobacco experts?
Well, they're tobacco men not connected with any cigarette company, like auctioneers, warehouse owners and operators, and independent buyers.
And they deal with all cigarette companies on an equal basis?
Yes, they do. And they have a reputation for being fair and square. That's what makes them a success in the tobacco business.
Thank you, Mr. Riggs. Ladies and gentlemen, these independent experts are present at every auction. They know just who buys what tobacco. And they're as free to choose their own cigarette as you or I. They see Lucky Strike pay the price to get the finer, the lighter, the naturally milder tobaccos. And they smoke Lucky's 2-to-1. Won't you profit by their example? Next time, ask for Lucky Strike.
Thank you, Mr. Cross. Now, Lucky Strike's losses for this week are $50 and 2 sets of the Encyclopedia Britannica. Thank you, Mr. Sheehan. Thank you, Mr. Taylor, for coming to Lucky Strike's party this evening. Now, next week, Mr. Kieran and Mr. Adams will again be with us, and we announce the return engagement of the distinguished attorney and New York State Congressman, Kenneth Simpson. And as our special guest, Judge James G. Wallace of the New York Court of General Sessions. Remember, for every question we use, whether or not it's answered correctly, the sender gets $10. If the question stumps our experts, you not only get $25 more, but in addition, the complete 24-volume set of the Encyclopedia Britannica. Send letters with questions and correct answers to Information Please, 480 Lexington Avenue, New York City. And now, a parting message from Mr. L.A. Speed Riggs, famous tobacco auctioneer of Goldsboro, North Carolina.
And that chant, fully interpreted, ladies and gentlemen, means Luckies pay higher prices for the finer, the lighter, the naturally milder tobaccos. With independent tobacco experts, auctioneers, buyers, warehousemen, with men who know tobacco best, it's Luckies 2-to-1.
This is the National Broadcasting Company.